Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service. Catch all the hard-hitting news and current affairs that focuses on all relevant First Nations issues from a First Nations standpoint. With your hosts, Bo Spearham and Karina Hogan.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we are broadcasting from. I'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which you're taking this broadcast from, whether it's over in Western Australia, South Australia, up in the Cape, down in Tassie, wherever it might be up the south coast, or right here in the beautiful sunny southeast Queensland. Thank you for joining us here on Let's Talk. I'd also like to acknowledge elders past, present and emerging. If you're listening, I'd like to acknowledge the part that you've played in paving the way for both Bo and I to sit here today and give you a little bit of Let's Talk. And it's Monday, the 11th, 2020 here in the wonderful, lovely studios at West End. Good morning, Bo. How are you?
Good, sis. Good, good. You know, yeah, good. It's been a good day. Busy morning, actually. You went for your run?
I went for a run. I'm putting that out here on radio because I'm letting my trainer know. I was a slack one. It took me 10 days to even start. And she gave me a 10-day like notice point before the starting point. So really it took me 20 days to start. But now that I've started, I feel like I'm really getting on top of it. My muscles were so sore on the weekend. I didn't know whether it was from the exercise or what. But I couldn't even bend down to pick up Chloe.
And that's not from the old days where you're just picking up beers and other stuff as well. So no, it's good, sis.
Well, we had our Christmas party on Friday night and yes. I didn't touch a drop of alcohol.
Yes, even though some people were trying to.
Yes, yeah, some people.
Nobody in here.
Yeah, nobody in here apparently except for Bo Spearham.
Come on,
sis, do you want a drink? Nope. And you know what? I was just saying this morning to Tari, I don't think that I've actually been to a Christmas party as an adult without actually having a drink, you know? And in all seriousness, I think it's really helped my mental health. I mean, I started this back in the beginning of October because I wanted to get involved in the Sober October thing, right? And then I realized that I'm getting so much more work done. My skin feels so much better. I'm feeling more fit. I'm there for my kids more. Mm-hmm. So it's working for me. I'm really glad that I started it.
That's deadly, sis. That is deadly. And you've been doing runs with Tyra and stuff as well.
Yeah. Well, actually, it's for Move It November.
Move It November.
Because we can't grow moustaches. Well, I could.
Some people can, yeah.
You know, I could if I wanted to, but, you know.
No one's judging.
So we do Move It November, which basically means get out there, move around for mental health and to promote the importance of getting checked out for also testicular cancer, I believe. Sorry, I may have that one wrong, but we're doing it for that as well. So we're raising a bit of money. If you want to give us some money or you want to support that, you can jump on our website, 989FM, where we are supporting Move It November, or jump on our Facebook page if you're not already. Mm. Also, the Walkleys were on Friday night, Bo.
Definitely. And as we're saying out there, you know, at least, you know, somebody from New South Wales got a three-peat.
Woo!
You know, the team didn't, so, you know, I'm upset at that.
Dry your tears. No, the
Walkleys was on, and, you know, if not one of the best Aboriginal journalists, you know, won another Walkley for their amazing journalism as well. And it happens to be Gumaray as well.
Well, yeah, Lorena Allam. Definitely
work.
Someone that that I look up to as a journalist. In fact, she was part of a panel along with someone else who happens to be here in the studios who were part of when I very first started as a cadet at ABC.
Mm.
And she won. She's just cleaning up. She's actually cleaned up quite a few Walkleys since she's left the ABC, isn't that right?
Yes. There was one for she teamed up with I don't know if it's the University of Newcastle.
Mm-hmm.
And there was the massacre map that the University of Newcastle put out under Dr. She's a historian, Lyndall Ryan. They've done amazing work within sort of this space, recording massacre sites around the country.
Yeah.
So she done like an interactive sort of article online with her team called, I believe it's called The Killing Times. which clean up at the Walkleys. They also done last year, I think it was, or the year before, they done the death database, looking at recording black deaths in custody over the last 10 years. And, you know, putting up information, photos, you know, when they got, when they heard back from families. But, you know, this resource that now, you know, I mean, other academics, people who sort of work within this space are using as well. And same as the Killing Times article that she done as well. So
if you haven't head to the Guardian website to have a look at that, please do. It gives an unbelievable unbelievable information around. And you can kind of hover over the areas and over the names of the people who have lost their lives.
Like, I think for some people it might be difficult to go to the Guardian, but if you just Google the deaf, I believe it's called the Death Database, or the Killing Times, and Lorena Allam, those things will come up, her work will come up, plus some other deadly articles she's done as well. And like a couple of years ago, I was a part of a boot camp with Spotify. She was one of the mentors and one of the people who came in and shared her experience within sort of radio, like, well, mainly the podcast space now. Yeah, so I've got to work with her through that as well.
Well, congratulations to Lorena. And it's important to also recognise Carla Walquist, who was also recognised. And this is particularly for their reporting of the Rio Tinto and BHP's activity in the Pilbara region, which, as we remember, the Juukan Gate caves that were sadly demolished under the BHP and Rio Tinto activity that was occurring in that region. And I have to say that their reporting on that, we've relied a lot on that throughout our time here at 98.9 FM, purely because they do such an amazing job.
And also earlier this year as well, Anani from Gomorrah Country was in court. She took the environmental minister to court and literally like 3 minutes after, you know, a couple of minutes after they walked out of court, she put up an article in regards to sort of what has happened, and as well, like so she went up. I'm sure she went into the hearing, you know, and like wrote her article as she was sitting there, and then like put it out, you know, not long after as well. So,
well, today's episode's going to be amazing because we've actually got another journalist in the studio who I think is 100% Walkley's award. Please see how he goes. He's got to cut in every time. Spotlight's not on you now, though.
Actually, it is. I'm under it.
Well, our first guest for today is someone who is an incredible journalist who has done extensive work in the radio industry, who is an absolute inspiration to me and a support to me. And last night she said her goodbyes to ABC after 19 years. Rhianna Patrick, good morning.
Good morning, sis. Hey, you marked that on.
Good morning.
See, I'm really nervous.
We've all done that.
I've got to say, I'm not going to lie. I am a little bit nervous because Rhianna is like a mentor to me and often does air checks. So that's why that happened. But anyway, moving along. Rhianna, I'll get you to tell us who your mob is and where you're from.
Oh, look, so born in Brisbane, mob from the Torres Strait, Zagreb from Mer. I've got connections also to Arab in the eastern part of the Torres Strait through my grandfather, and Wagadugim mob through the west, Mobiag Island through my grandmother on the western side of the Torres Strait.
Deadly.
Biggest mob, but grew up in Weipa on the western side of Cape York. Totally. So claim a lot of places as home, really.
Well, you can't not when you're blackfella.
Yeah, true.
You know, like,
true.
Like you, like I claim place where I never even lived. You know, like that's home. You know, like, you know, my grandmother was born there, my grandfather was born. That's home. You know, but like that's how it is with my mob. You know, like we have that connection, you know, through bloodline, through you know, cultural heritage, well, whatever. But also, sis, you know, talking of connection as well, and you know, you being with, you know, one of the biggest sort of news outlets in the country. Before you got there, could you tell us a bit about how you got involved in radio and in journalism as well?
Yeah, look, I was a journalism student at the University of Queensland, and the founder of this radio station, one of the founders, had walked in to do a lecture, obviously Uncle Tiger, and I went up to him afterwards and just had a chat, and he was like, you should come in, and I'm like, okay, sure. And it just turned out I'd come in. At that stage there was the Murray Newsroom, which used to do just Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander news on the opposite ends to the hours. So that's what you would work towards every day, and that's what, you know, at the end of the week you'd have a current affair Affairs show that you would put together. And so I did a couple of weeks work experience in that and really liked it. And then I kind of got busy again with university and, you know, working your way through university because you always have to work as well. And had rung thinking, oh, I should probably do some more. And on the day that I rang, their news director had quit. Because he was going off to travel the world. And he was like, do you want to actually come in and, are you interested? And so that's how I ended up starting in the Murray newsroom and getting a job in there and loving doing that. And not long, I think it was about a couple of months after starting in the Murray newsroom, the breakfast announcer position became available. And Uncle Tiger was like, do you want to do the breakfast show? And I was like, sure.
It's funny because, like... It's funny because I think nearly everybody that's in the building, yeah, that has ever worked for 98.9 FM has actually done a show.
Yes.
Whether they were, you know, coming in to do, you know, I think Uncle Pete wasn't even originally on air, but then he ended up, you know, hosting, you know, a show for almost, you know, 19 to 15 years or even longer, maybe.
Yeah.
Winning a Deadly as well, you know,
yeah,
like.
Yeah, I was there for that. Hey. I was there in Sydney for that when he won. Yes.
Or if you're doing one show, you know, like you know, like there's something else that opens up as well. You know, like I think you've hosted a few shows here.
The breakfast
show, yeah. Yeah. I done The Drive one time as well. So, like, it's, you know, you're like, yeah, you get to sort of experience sort of different shows, yeah. But then also, you know, like, you know, like you're saying, you know what I mean? Like you end up doing a show if you stay long enough.
And it almost becomes home, hey? Like you were saying before, like those places you've never actually been. This is like a bit of a home for us, hey?
I often feel like I'm coming home when I come here to hang out because it's – and, you know, and I wasn't necessarily in this building or this space.
I was
in the old one back in those old days, you know.
Well, I've got a question, sis. Like you said, you started in the Murray newsroom. What was reporting on black issues like back then? You know, there's ABC Indigenous, you know, there's NITV, we've got NERS, there's sort of all these different regional
Indigenous
or national sort of Aboriginal news outlets. What was it like back then?
Oh, look, it was such an incredibly exciting time. You know, I used to have a lot of conversations with Karma News in Central Australia.
What year did you start? Because I think this next
98.
Year... 98. Next year is 30 years of Courier Mail, so
yes,
that would have been around.
It had started and I, you know, the Courier Mail was actually one of the first things I ever saw when I walked into 98.9 I didn't even know that this paper existed and that all of this, you know, so I think it was a really exciting time where we were constantly in contact with Central Australia and Karma News. We were constantly in contact with Simon News in the Torres Strait, constantly in contact with 4K1G in Townsville.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you'd have a chance to chat to Galari in Western Australia. So you'd constantly be sort of just ringing those regular people who had newsrooms and who were pumping out news to kind of find out, well, what was their top story? Was that something they could send us? And back in the day, it was down the line.
Yeah.
So you'd have to
put
the phone in and you'd have to record it into we just got digital technology at that point. So I was on reel-to-reel at university and I was on digital technology in the Indigenous radio station I was working in. So it was this really weird time of technology. And you know, it was the start of, you know, ATSIC, you know, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Commission was very much in its place. So you were constantly interviewing the commissioners, you were constantly interviewing the chair people of that organisation. It was a time of changes in native title. It was, you know, the time WIC had just happened. Then you had John Howard's 10-point WIC plan that came out. You obviously had the Mabo decision earlier in that time, around the same time that, you know, the Courier Mail was starting. But the echoes of what had just happened was still kind of throughout the late 90s as well. And it was this really exciting time in news of seeing those Indigenous organisations setting up, those Indigenous, I suppose, government bodies in a way, who were there to, you know, to be our voice and to be our voice on a federal level. But it was also a really interesting time, I think, because you mentioned, you know, now we have all of these other different places. We can go to The Guardian to find Indigenous news. We've got ABC Indigenous.
All these outlets now have, you know,
Yeah, and I suppose back in the day when you were looking for news that was done in a unbiased, fair, transparent way, it would, you know, you didn't have very many media outlets to turn to at that time if you were looking for a non-Indigenous point of view. You know, we always had Indigenous radio in this country, so we always had our own voices on air telling those stories and giving our perspectives. But I think at that time, non-Indigenous outlets, there were very few where you didn't see yourself as a deficit narrative, where you didn't see yourself as a stereotype, where you didn't see yourself in the negative. So to find those positive stories was actually very hard at the time. And I think that's the beauty of Indigenous radio and particularly Koori Mail. You could see those positive stories. You could hear those positive stories and know that you were a part of this very large, vibrant community that were doing so many different things.
Yeah.
But we could have fun doing that. We could do things that really mattered. And it wasn't just whatever the budget was giving money towards at that particular time, you know, that those issues existed, yes, and we understood that. But it was also nice to know that there was this other end to our community that very few people saw at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I discovered you in about 2008, 2009.
Yeah, I think it was.
Maybe a little bit earlier than that. But you were on, you were the host of Speaking Out.
I was.
I loved that program. Tell us about what that journey was like.
Oh, look, taking over a legacy National Indigenous program, there's a lot of responsibility that comes with that. And you're acutely aware of what the history is, of why that program exists, of who those people were that fought for that program and who those people were who fought for that program to stay on air. And so Speaking Out turned 30 this year, which is, I think, a big accomplishment for any Indigenous radio program on a mainstream organisation in this country. And I think it's sometimes the history that gets forgotten is the importance of having something like that, that while it's great that we have Indigenous radio for our mob, that it's, you know, we also need to get our message to non-Indigenous people too, and having that platform, but also having representation. You know, I think representation really matters, and it really mattered for me for Speaking Out. So I'd taken over after Karen Durante. So Karen,
shout out
for
to
me.
Karen, she's still upstairs.
Shout out. You know, for me, Karen was one of those people, you know, as a fellow Torres Strait Islander and as a fellow Torres Strait Islander woman as well, being able to see her. And like, I grew up seeing her do her job. So when I was sitting on your side of the desk, that was the person who I would see out in community all the time doing stories. That was the person that I would have conversations to about, you know, one day maybe working for the ABC. These, you know, these were the people that I was having conversations to. And so I was very aware of what I was taking over at the time. But also, if it hadn't been for her when I was at Triple J News forcing me to go and cover the deadlies for her and saying, I want a package, you can just drop it in Saturday morning for Sunday night, that'd be great, thank you.
Fabulous.
You know, when the program was still live, you know, if it wasn't for her pushing me, and if it wasn't for people like Lorena Allum, particularly on Away, pushing me as well, and Daniel Browning, because Daniel at the time, when I started at the ABC, he was the Triple J News team leader. So to have an Indigenous man as the head of Triple J News at the time was just phenomenal. But to then be able to work under him was another experience altogether. And then when he went over to Away and left Triple J, you know, he was constantly, when I was in my regional posting, ringing, going, can you do this story? You know, Lorena was constantly, hey, I think this would be great. Do you reckon you've got time to turn something around? So I really appreciate being made to do things because it did push me out of where I was thinking, because for me, I, you know, if I hadn't started on a radio program here at 98.9, I don't think I would have ever considered being a broadcaster at all. I don't think that I just wanted to do radio news. That's all I wanted to do. I just wanted to do radio journalism. It's, and to then have another string to your bow and something that I hadn't considered was something I'd never really expected. It was different to kind of take that on, but it also skill-wise gave me so much more that meant I was way more ahead when I joined the ABC in that I knew how to mix a program. I knew how to do these things that I had to do.
And if you've just joined us here at 98.9 FM's Let's Talk program, we're yarning with Rhianna Patrick, proud Torres Strait Islander woman, former ABC presenter, producer extraordinaire, and now working for Indigenous X and doing a whole range of other things. Sis, let's turn our attentions to the fact that you've now announced that you're finishing up
Well, I've finished.
You've finished
it's
up,
done.
Rather.
It's done.
Done and dusted. Sis, I'm going to read out what you wrote on Twitter last night, which has gotten quite a massive response. After nearly 19 years at the ABC, I've decided it's time to move on, and today I got 10 minutes to say goodbye to ABC Re audience. I had taken 3 months' leave without pay to deal with the Black Lives Matter trauma I was going through, which slowly turned into what I am now calling ABC trauma. What surfaced were memories of things I had buried because I needed to go get on with my job at the time, but I started to remember it all. As an Indigenous person working within a mainstream media organisation, it's a hard job. On the one hand, you want to see your community represented, but on the other, you're navigating getting your job done as a minority in a very non-Indigenous workplace. The emotional labour is exhausting, along with constantly having to fight to make change, which is why I ask the ABC to do better by its Indigenous staff and do it in a real and genuine way that shows you are listening to what Indigenous staff are telling you. I've wanted to work for the ABC since I was six and growing up in the Cape with one television channel. I'm grateful that I got to fulfil my dream, and I could never have imagined all the things I ended up doing all those years ago. I'm so incredibly grateful to those who tuned in to national programs I fronted over the years. So thank you for listening, calling and sharing your stories with me. Thanks also if you said yes to being a guest interviewee on anything I've worked on in over the years. I'm very much looking forward to joining the Indigenous X team through the support of and generosity of the Judith Nelson Institute for Journalism and Ideas. I'll be heading up Indigenous X's audio and podcasts. I'm also working on an exhibition about the Torres Strait for mid next year, and I'll continue to curate the original Storytellers playlist for Spotify AU, which you can find here. I'm excited about what the future holds. Looking forward to being on Twitter more. Now, Rhianna, let's talk about that. What an amazing journey that you have had. Talk to me about when you talk about ABC trauma, you know, that's something that really stands out there. You know, I can relate because I was with ABC at the very same time during that. I want to hear your story behind that and how you feel about, you know, finally letting go of ABC and the process behind that.
Yeah, I think it was something that, look, I over the years have had many conversations with former Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander ABC staff that you meet along the way. You interview someone and they will say to you, oh, yeah, I used to work at the ABC back in the 80s or whenever it was. And I was always intrigued as to why they left. So it would be one of the questions that I would say to them if we were talking, if you're okay with it, can you tell me, you know, what was your experience and why did you leave? And it became obvious to me that as an Indigenous staffer within the ABC, there's a lot that you take on. And at the time, you don't realise you're taking it on because you're trying to get your job done. You're trying to represent your community. You're trying to make sure that your community is represented appropriately and fairly and correctly, and all of those responsibilities that go into who you are and why you've decided to do the job that you do and what it is that you want to get out of that. And, you know, and for me, going in was about making change. For me, it was about going in and making sure that those positive stories were heard. For me, it was about getting more voices on air. It was about hearing from people you wouldn't normally hear from. And it was also about, for me, you know, I was thinking about, well, you know, I was lucky to have Karen Durante. Who comes after me? Who is that next person for the next person in terms of a Torres Strait Islander presenter coming up the ranks? And for a very long time, I was the only Torres Strait Islander presenter on a radio program. And I think this year has been the first time it's been really peak Islander, because we've had Christine Arnoux on Friday and Saturday nights nationally. I was on Sunday nights. And then now we've got Dave Woodhead over at Triple J doing lunchtimes. So to have three Torres Strait Islanders fronting national programs at the ABC is something that I never thought would happen in my time, because when I joined, there was one, and that was Karen Durante. There was one. You know, and so I think what you take on in a workplace like that, where, you know, I worked on Indigenous programming, but towards the end, in the last 5 years, I've worked on a non-Indigenous program. And for me, it was interesting, because when I was on the Indigenous program, I would constantly hear from people once a year around NAIDOC Week.
Mm.
Maybe now it's twice a year around Reconciliation Week and NAIDOC Week, you know, but that was the only time they would ever want my expertise. And I think that's the difference, is that our expertise as Indigenous journalists is not seen as expertise. Mm. It's seen as being innately a part of us, but what they don't understand is what you're navigating, doing your job and trying to do your job well. You're trying not to insert yourself into community issues, but you want to try to find out what the issue is that community is dealing with. You're trying to treat people respectfully. You're building relationships. These are people that you don't have one interview with and then you walk away from. You are maintaining a relationship with that person after that time, and you're trying to do that on top of doing your job as well. And so for me, what I hadn't realised was that once the Black Lives Matter trauma had dissipated, what was coming up was everything that I had buried of my experiences of working in a mainstream media organisation. And it's really hard to articulate that when you aren't going through it, or you don't have the experiences that Indigenous and people of colour have within a mainstream media organisation. So once I started to realise, and what also triggered it was 30 years of speaking out, because I was getting interviews about being there for the 20th anniversary, which I had to organise largely by myself. I was working on a national program by myself. And I was trying to put together this major event to celebrate 20 years and acknowledge the importance of this program, while also still trying to put my program to air, because that didn't stop. And at the time, my grandmother had passed, and I was trying to deal with all of that. And I actually didn't want to come back to do the event, and it was really hard to be there as the presenter going through all of that. Sorry, I'm getting a little emotional.
No, that's okay.
About it.
And Rihanna, I can absolutely feel the passion you had there. And you said in that tweet, that part that really sticks out to me is where you said that you come up with these two different kind of things, right? You want to get those messages through for your mob, and you have that responsibility, but then at the same time, you know, you just want to do your job, and sort of wrestling with those two things and going, you know, how do you do that in a mainstream organisation that essentially, and I can relate, doesn't understand and doesn't do the right things to understand, you know, what is important to properly deliver that, the relationships, you know, but also understanding that when you stuff up and you make a mistake in the community, and then you're used as you know, the face of or whatever, like, it falls back on you.
Yeah, yeah, and that's the responsibility I think they don't understand, is that when you realise something is wrong in a story, or it's not right, or they've spelt someone's name wrong, that's a big issue for you. Mm-hmm. As an Indigenous person sitting there knowing that they've spelt that person's name wrong, who's from your community, it's a big issue.
Mm.
But they just, oh, well.
Well,
you know,
remember.
And the amount of times they can't spell Torres Strait. I'm sorry, it's a body of water. It's not a straight line. Get on board. Like, it is constant.
I giggle because we used to make jokes about it.
We did.
And I remember coming to you actually in about 2018 Invasion Day, when they had Uncle Sam Watson on, who brought this issue to the forefront about ABC not doing the right thing as far as bringing black voices forward. And my name was actually used as an example of someone that was there. Little did the presenter know at the time that, you know, I was experiencing exactly what Uncle Sam was talking about, but also that I stand strong with my community, you know. And now, sis.
Yeah.
Thank the good lords above, you're going to be sticking around with black media and making some waves, bigger waves, I reckon, with Indigenous X, Spotify. You've got so much coming up and so much happening. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so, oh, wow.
Walker's coming up.
Yes, woo!
I'm so excited, so excited, and just so grateful, because it was always my plan to go to the ABC and then come back to Indigenous media. So to come back to a place like Indigenous X, .com.au, new website's up, just doing my job, is like, I'm grateful to Luke and the team for asking me to join, really. And I'm really excited as what the possibility can be in the podcasting space, because I know that over COVID there have been a lot of Indigenous podcasts released, and it's been really interesting to see where they kind of fall on what the stories are that people want to tell, the conversations that people want to tell, and the conversations that people want to have. And so I've been looking for where those gaps are of what it is that we can offer into that space. But I think it's also largely about capacity building. You know, podcasting is definitely, it's not a new thing, but I think it is a new thing in terms of having the amount of Indigenous podcasts that we have in this country that we can go to that are Indigenous made by Indigenous people for Indigenous people on a variety of different topics. And they're not all necessarily tied to our indigeneity, but they're speaking whatever it is that speaks to them. And I love that. And so to be able to develop that, like, I mean, obviously, Bo, I know what you gave to Spotify as one of the judges, but I was excited by what you wanted to bring, particularly with the podcast that you wanted to do, because it was definitely something we hadn't seen before. And it was really unique. And I mean, I don't know if you see that as someone who's in that podcasting space that I'm talking about.
No, to be honest, I just wanted to sort of tell a story. You know, I love history, you know, and I just sort of, you know, wanted to sort of tell those stories in a podcast platform, you know, and I honestly never thought I'd be talking, you know, to academics and, to, you know, I never knew that I'd, like, the route that I'd go, that I'd be down right now, the road that would take me down at the moment, you know, with the people I've spoken to, but then also the amount of people that are, that have sort of, that have been drawn to it and have enjoyed it as well. Because like I said, I thought this was interesting, you know, and so, like, I wanted to pursue it, you know, and I held on to it for like 5-6 years without saying anything to anyone about my idea and what I wanted to do as well. But like, what I wanted to say, so I didn't want to talk about the podcast, to be honest. what I wanted to say was I got sent some numbers. Australia is like in the top 10 or 5 of podcasting. You know, so there is a massive market within this country for podcasting as well. I think, you know, they were mentioning like the market here is like, you know, 90 to like $50 million. They said in like 10, 15 years, it's going to be triple to 4 times more that, you know, that, you know, like the podcasting space, you know, would be worth within this country alone as well. But yeah, and you know, like you're saying, I remember when I ordered like the podcasting gear, I was like, oh, has many been ordered? He goes, yeah, you know, like what you're getting now is sort of like the hottest thing on the market at the moment. So, you know, we're getting rid of these as quick as they are they're coming in. So, but now it's been amazing to sort of see through that COVID period the many different conversations coming out and sort of, you know, mob taking up that space as well.
It's absolutely wonderful. I love it. I can't wait to see what you're going to do, Rhianna. You've already done so much. And I just want to say, from me personally, congratulations and thank you for supporting me through so much over the last, I've been there 10 years now and finishing up soon, hopefully. And then finishing up soon, actually. And but in all seriousness, thank you so much for all the amazing work you've done in the Indigenous space, in the mainstream space, in every space. You're an incredible person and we have the utmost respect for you here.
And, like, you know, just before, you know, you got a bit upset and emotional talking about, you know, when things got a bit too hard for you, you know, you're coming out of sort of where you are at the end of sort of your ABC career. Was it hard to sort of come to that? To write that post?
Because not really. I've been thinking about it for a while, I think. And I think for me it was just how do I get it across without it sounding angry or sounding as though, you know, I was still going through this. And I think the point I got a little bit teary was saying goodbye to all my regular guests because a lot of them had been with me for 5 years and a lot of them had come on this really crazy journey of some very odd content. And that was the point that, because it meant I wouldn't get to talk to them, you know, once a month as I was and have those really interesting conversations that I loved, which were about everything, you know? So I don't think it was too hard writing that. And I think, you know, coming out the other side, it's, you know, it's just been good being able to have Indigenous people there to talk to, but also ex-ABC Indigenous people to talk to who I know have gone through the same thing. So that's been really good of just relinking in with a bunch of us who had, you know, people who had left before me and just, you know, touching base and having those conversations.
Yeah, well, you definitely left a mark on the ABC, but I'm more excited about the mark you're about to leave on the media world in general. So thank you so much for joining us today, Rhianna Patrick.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And that was Rhianna Patrick. She is former ABC presenter, producer extraordinaire, and now working for Indigenous X, working with Spotify. We're going to keep up to date with Rhianna in the future, but she's requested Thelma Plum, Better in Black. Haven't you, sis? Why do you like this song?
Because I definitely am better in black.
Hey, look out. And you're listening to 98.9 FM, Let's Talk.
Mob, have you had an eye test recently? We should be seeing the optometrist every 2 to 3 years, or every year if you are living with diabetes. Don't forget your little ones too. They should be getting their first eye test before they turn 5, and their second eye test within 5 years, as long as they have no issues. School screenings don't replace normal eye tests, so book your little one in for an eye test at your local clinic before they start school, and set them up for a bright future. The Institute for Urban Indigenous Health has partnered with the Fred Hollows Foundation to give our mob a free pair of stylin' sunnies when you get your eye test.
Too deadly!
So head down to your local participating clinic today. To find your closest clinic, head to iuih.org.au/findaclinic.
A message from the Institute for Urban Indigenous Health.
Station sponsor.
This is Bo Spearham and Karina Hogan with Let's Talk.
And that was the beautiful Thelma Plum with Better in Black. And, Bo, we got to interview the beautiful Thelma Plum, your younger sister.
Yeah, she's the youngest, yes.
About 2 weeks ago.
Yes, what a treat that was. We had our NAIDOC you know, COVID obviously stuffed up, you know, our normal sort of NAIDOC schedule, and moved it to earlier this month. And so mob all around the country were having their celebrations. We're usually really busy. We're in Brisbane. We have Anala NAIDOC, Acacia Ridge NAIDOC, Logan NAIDOC, Northside NAIDOC, Ipswich NAIDOC, and then the big one Friday.
And then Stratty NAIDOC as well. And then all the hundreds of morning tea NAIDOCs in between.
All the cups of teas for the elders and the tents and all the different NAIDOC events. And then also the organisations do theirs as well. Mm-hmm. So if we don't fit one in with an organisation, we usually just, you know, have teams at our NAIDOC events and then the big one Friday. Obviously, due to COVID, nobody celebrated like that this year. We certainly didn't. So I think what work wanted to do was sort of still have our outside broadcast. So I think it took work a couple of months to sort of get it all sorted, obviously due to COVID, because the restrictions kept going up and down. And then once it sort of finally opened up, work was like, hey, you know, we want to do an outside broadcast and we want to have some live music. We're not going to promote it because we don't want to put too many people at risk. We're just going to do it, send some invites out to sort of certain individuals in the community that support us and who we support. We went live from the Brekkie Show, which is from 5, and then also to the Murray Hour, I believe it was around 12 o'clock, which it sort of got moved back. So obviously Clay and Emma went live, we went live, and then after us, Dan and also Eli went live as well.
Yeah, it was a deadly day.
It was a great morning.
It was a deadly day. We need to do it again.
Scattered with musicians.
I would do it every week if I could. I loved it.
Well, we were doing a live broadcast every week down at the kiosk.
Yeah, my mum and aunt came along. It was it's deadly. Yeah, we revamped the kiosk space.
Dan and some of the uncles and aunties have been down there nearly every day.
Dwayne Doyle has done some amazing artwork down there. If you are in the West End area in Brisbane, go down and check out the kiosk, which is on Boundary Street.
You can't not miss it. You can't not miss it when you walk through Boundary Street.
And I've noticed like lots more black fellas hanging about, you know, which is really good to see. I love it.
It's good to see the mob, you know, back here as well.
And at the beginning of the program, we were yarning with the amazing Rhianna Patrick, who has just finished up at the ABC and is doing some amazing stuff in the space, but brought forward quite a few interesting topics, Bo. I think something that I can absolutely relate to.
That when you leave ABC, you win Walkleys.
Oh, well, and apparently Lorena Allum.
So, you know, like there's some big shoes for Rhianna to fill. Like we're expecting some Walkleys out here.
Yeah.
So sister girl, come on. Again.
I have absolutely no doubt that that Rhianna will be walking away with a Walkley at some point soon. Mm. In the second half of the program, we're going to be yarning with some amazing women that have been doing some healing work in the trauma-informed space. Now, you know, slightly linked, I suppose, with what Rhianna was talking about, you know, trauma in the workplace type thing. But these ladies have dedicated much of their life to working with and teaching other people about the importance of trauma. Both join us today, one in the studio.
And I guess it's sort of like, you know, how to work with it and how to deal with it as well is a big thing, because I guess like we do that anyways. You know, and, you know, I think it affects people when we work in like a negative space with it as well. So, you know, and I think sometimes we get sort of stuck within that place, not knowing that we're in that place as well, you know, because I think traumas, you know, it gives us traits, you know, that we sort of use to deal
and
with
a lot
in certain
of it's
places.
Like subconscious, which,
yeah.
you know. I'm not the professional, but I know that I've been yarning and doing work with Weali for about a year on my own personal journey. People know that, and I'm quite open, that I live with depression and lost my father, and it was really difficult for me. And I realised and recognised that the traditional forms, well, when I say traditional forms, I mean in white Australia, traditional forms of therapy, you know, could only go so far. Western medicine can only go so far, Bo. So my moving into the space of understanding my trauma as a child, and even my family's past trauma and how that affects me.
Definitely.
I think more broadly, especially in First Nations communities, it just is so pertinent, right? So our guest this morning is Aunty Judy K. Knox and Dr. Catherine Chamberlain. Good morning, Dr. Catherine
morning.
Chamberlain and
Aunty Judy. Good morning.
Aunty Judy.
Just before we start, could I get either one of you to tell us your mob and your country? And just when we're talking to the mic, just like a bit of a handspan away. Or what we can do is maybe move that mic towards you.
Yeah.
A bit closer.
So we'll get you, Dr. Kath, to introduce your name and your mob.
Thanks, Aunt.
Great. Hi, I'm Associate Professor Kath Chamberlain, and my mop is Trawlways, from the northeast coast of Tasmania, and really delighted to be here with you this morning.
It's deadly to have a black fella from Tasmania on the program. And Anikath, you've been doing a lot of work in the Indigenous health equity space, developing kind of strength-based, family-focused strategies relating to birth, early childhood and pregnancy. And we'll get to that in a sec. But Annie Kay, can you introduce us and tell us... Annie Judy Kay, can you introduce yourself and tell us who your mob is?
Yeah, my name's Judy Kay Knox. I'm Gomeroi and Manandangi and a bit of Kuma as well.
Big mob, biggest mob.
Shout out.
Now, today we want to talk about trauma-informed practice. And Dr. Kath, I found out a little bit of information about you last week because I have quite an interest in the maternity space. So I discovered that you are doing some amazing work in the space of understanding trauma as far as birthing, pregnancy and early childhood is concerned. Can you tell us a little bit about that work that you're doing there?
Yeah, thanks, Karina. So I lead a project with a totally deadly Aboriginal team, predominantly Aboriginal and also non-Indigenous allies, called Healing the Past by Nurturing the Future. And in this project, we're working with communities to co-design strategies to support Aboriginal parents experiencing complex trauma.
And can you tell me, so basically, Dr. Kath, I've been doing a little bit of work with a program called Birthing in Our Community here in Brisbane where I had my babies and just trying to get some information out there for women. And you know what one of my biggest issues is finding and trying to nail down like just five or six topics because there are so many things as far as trauma is concerned when it comes to whether it's birthing trauma, transgenerational trauma, and all those outer factors that impact, number one, the mother who's having the baby, but also the baby when they're first born. Can you tell us about the importance of addressing those issues in those earlier stages?
Sure, it's critically important. So we know, trauma essentially is a natural response to something that's happened, like it's our defensive, our fight, flight and freeze response to trauma. So it's defensive. It's a normal response to something that's happened. It's really critically important during the transition to parenting, particularly as a lot of the trauma, most of the research that's been done around trauma is around war experiences and PTSD related to that. But we're understanding now that most people aren't traumatised by those events, but by things that have happened during our own childhood and also other birth traumas and things like that. But one of the things that can happen when we become parents ourselves is it can stir up a lot of those early childhood memories. Mm. And because it happened a long time ago, it might even be before memory because we don't really develop our memories till we're around three or four. And so it can be really deeply embedded and it can be quite distressing if, once a defensive response has been activated in response to one threat, it can be more readily activated by anything resembling that. So that could be, the smell, it could be sounds, it could be sensations, it could be a baby crying, it could be any of those things. We know that there's a lot of these things happening that can trigger these responses more around this transitioning to parenting. So that can be really distressing if people are having those experiences and not understanding that this is actually a natural response. So that is one thing that's really important. It's more common at that time. The second reason why it's critically important is we know this is the best time for healing. So we know from qualitative studies that people talk about this has been a real time of post-traumatic growth. And we also know from longitudinal studies that they've done overseas in America that people who have suffered severe trauma are more likely to recover this time than any other time during their life. Like, it stirs things up, but it really is a good time to address it. And it's for a whole lot of reasons that we don't yet fully understand, but related to the love that children bring into the world with them. It's love that is the healing salve of trauma. And building that, babies do all this natural stuff to make us love them. It's a defense, a protective thing for babies as well to make sure that we care for them properly. So there's a whole lot of opportunities there. It's the absolute best time for healing. And also, you know, you have contact with services a lot at that time. So that's why we've called the project Healing the Past by Nurturing the Future, because it's actually that nurturing and loving that is going to help us through that healing journey.
How, how you going? It's Bo.
Hey, Bo.
I was just wondering too, you know, through that as well, how do we, you know, how does trauma transfer, you know, to kids? You know, like, you know, how does it get to them? And then, yeah, I guess that's sort of the question there.
Yeah, that's a really good question, because we know prior to colonisation, Aboriginal kids weren't, you know, were far healthier than non-Aboriginal kids at that time. We weren't sending our kids down mines. We weren't sending them off to boarding schools. They weren't getting beaten. And a lot of the trauma that arrived with the with the people that had come off the prison hulks in England and around there, and people have been since arriving with their own trauma from all parts of the globe. And a lot of that has been inflicted on Aboriginal people here, and that we're seeing that now. We can see that clearly with the epidemiology, that trauma is being passed on, and it's having a compounding intergenerational effect
DNA, like the memory, like how does that?
It's more it's a sort of complicated process, but it's more the effects of trauma are being passed, impacting on parents' ability to parent.
Oh, yes.
And can provide care for their own children. And then there's also a whole lot of different things in the environment and the housing instability, the community stuff that's going on in the community, and also the socioeconomic deprivation that compounds that original trauma and the racism and all the other things that go with it.
There are so many factors.
There's some talk about epigenetics, which is still quite that's still a fair bit of debate around that. And
what is epigenetic? Like me.
So that's where the environment can turn on some of the genetic traits. So I'm not the right best person to be. I should be researching this before I talk about it. But it's not a genetic mutation as such, but some traits of the genes can be turned on by exposure to some environmental factors. So trauma, it's thought that trauma can, you know, may turn some of those genetic traits on.
It's got here, epigenetics involves genetic control by factors other than an individual's DNA sequence.
But how much it actually changes the genetic structure is still under debate, and it's how much, you know, it's some people describe it as like sunburn, similar thing. It can cause but how far that actually transmits through into the genetic structure, we're not sure. But it certainly there's things that happen when a parent is exposed during pregnancy to stress, that there's things that affect the telomere length of the babies that are born. And we know even just after things like the Queensland floods,
there was a study
the babies born after that, that babies were born with high cortisol responses and things like that.
So all of that is interesting, yeah. Dr. Kathleen Chamberlain. And I want to bring Judy K. Knox into the conversation. And I want to ask about, burying trauma. Like if we have a situation where, you know, I have a baby or you've just given birth or whatever, and I've realised, oh, gosh, I'm, quite actually sad, but I just bury it and I just get on with it and just forget about it and just sort of go on with and go, I don't want to focus on the terrible things that are happening. You know, what are your thoughts around that?
That's it. The longer we sit on our trauma without, breaking it down and looking at it from all angles and understanding how it unfolded in the first instance, it needs, the body holds the memories. And it will manifest into some sort of ailment, and up to cancers. We know that diabetes and heart disease are two of the biggest killers of our people. And it all can be traced to the holding of the memories within the body. And it needs...
Your issues are in your tissues. I remember Antonia Berkman saying that to me when I was working with her. Your issues are in your tissues, sis. Let's deal with that.
That's right. You know, and it takes more than just a talk fest, which, you know, Western psychology handles. You often hear people say, oh, you know, I've been in therapy for 20 years and they still haven't worked out what's going on.
Yeah, right.
You know, so the release of trauma needs to be a physical one, because it biologically affects us and physiologically affects our systems.
Do you think it affects more people than we know, than they realise?
For sure.
It's subconscious, do you think?
Yeah, obviously. You know, like,
but it manifests.
A lot of people are in trauma that don't even know what the trauma story is. Mm. And you need to be in a therapeutic process to uncover what that story is, because in the case for Aboriginal people, it's multiple stories. We know that, you know, like one of the biggest things with our youth is anger. But anger is a secondary emotion, so there's always something underneath it, and it's generally fear or grief.
Mm-hmm.
And we've lost so much, and it doesn't just mean, you know, the physical loss of another human. We've lost language, we've lost stories, we've lost place, we've lost connection.
Mm.
And that wreaks havoc on the psyche, you know.
Now, you work for an organisation called WEALI, or you're part of that organisation as a cultural advisor and facilitator there, which is the same place that Antonia happens to work at. And I believe, Kathy, you guys, you know, have drawn a lot from Annie Judy Ann Atkinson in your practice as well. You speak a lot about things like Didiri and inner listening. And that kind of stuff. Kath and Judy, how important is something like deep listening, Didiri being deep listening, in the practice that you both do? We'll start with you.
Judy. Well, you know, listening is more than just with the ears.
Mm.
We need to energetically connect with somebody in order to, you know, help them bring up what's locked in the body, because like I said before, you know, a lot of our people that are in deep trauma don't actually know what the trauma story is.
Yeah.
So in a Western psychological way, you know, it's sort of ego-based, where they're going to tell you what's wrong with you. But the work that we do, it's about resonating with that person in order to be that friend sitting next to them to help draw the story out, which is, in the therapeutic process, the latest research is saying that Indigenous practices, not only just Aboriginal practices, but Indigenous peoples from all around the world, have processes and practices in place that allow the release of ill feelings, bad feelings, before it manifests in
That's
trauma.
Interesting, Annie Judy, because I was talking to Dr. Kath at the weekend, or just before the weekend, about something similar to that. And in your work, Dr. Kath, you mentioned a lady up in Yolngu who is doing her PhD about the way that blackfellas would traditionally parent, right? Can you tell us a little bit about that? I'm conscious that you've got to go as well, so...
Associate Professor Laupa Maupalima has done a lot of work up there looking at traditional ways of parenting, and also Dr. Michelle McMahon down in Victoria has done quite a lot, and it really points to the sophisticated ways that we had of parenting our children and developing. We're all familiar with the social emotional well-being model that we have, centered around connectedness to ourselves, our community, our land, our spirituality, and the like. But we also had sophisticated ways in our parenting to foster that connectedness and relatedness. And, you know, it's really exciting to see researchers like Professor Laupa and Michelle.
And I guess like parenting back then to now was totally different, because, you know, if, you know, the mother or the father was struggling, I guess there would have been other people within that family group that would have took that on, that responsibility. Because I guess you know, and I guess I get one reason why there's such high rates of, you know, mothers sort of, you know, experiencing depression and anxiety is because I guess they're feeling like they're alone within it today.
Well, it takes a village, to raise a child.
It's interesting you say that, because one of the titles of the stories I was doing last week relating to this was takes a village to raise a child, and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have been doing this for thousands of years. So, yeah. It truly does. Do you think that we've lost that in this day and age, you know, from Western influence, from social media, all those types of things?
Traditionally, our children were the centrepiece of the community. You know, everything revolved around them. They were our most prized, I hate to use the word possessions, but our most prized part of the tribe, you know? Yeah, so with this transgenerational trauma, unless we have the hard-hitting conversations about where we need to go with childhood trauma, it's getting worse and worse by the generations.
And if you've just joined us here at 98.9 FM, we're yarning with Dr. Kath Chamberlain, who is an associate professor at the Judith Lumley Centre, and also Annie Judy Kay,
I was just going to say, Aunt, just on that last part there, you said, you know, each generation, it's sort of getting harder and harder. You know, whose fault is that? You know, obviously it's not the kids' fault or the generation before that, because are we sort of sitting in a time where we don't know what's going on within ourselves and with the trauma?
Well, you know, if you look at it, look at all the stresses that we have to live with. You know, we're living below the poverty line. We've got financial stresses. We've got
Racism,
the deaths of people, you know, like traditionally we had processes that dealt with the grief, you know, for certain periods of time. Now it's just bang, 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 one after the other. So when we attend a funeral today, we're not only grieving that person there but all the other ones.
It's layered.
Like, I remember,
so we never get through it. So, you know, with all these factors going on simultaneously, no one's even thinking of a path out. They're just trying to live and survive.
That reactionary kind of ambulance at the bottom of the hill thing. And but in order to actually grasp the whole, the whole gamut of it all.
Or even, like, you know, we see family more often at funerals than we do any other time.
That's right.
Does that have an effect on us, knowing that we're going to see our family more at funerals than...
Of course, you know, even if it's not spoken about, it's, you know, it's just a part of the setup. You know, I mean, yeah, it's pretty distressing that...
And, like, the labour and the labour that it has to go to a funeral. Like, I remember I went home a month ago and there was one early that week, then there was one in a town, you know, that's an hour and a half away, like, that where we have connection to. And then there's another funeral the next day, you know, in another town, like, 2 hours away as well, you know. So, like, like you're saying, you know what I mean? Like, you know, our community's not getting a chance to sort of sit and grieve or sort of deal with what we're going through.
So then how do we do that? Kath, can you tell me, do you have ideas around how we can do that, or resources that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, or even just people in general, can access?
Well, I agree all these things are really much bigger than one of us, and I think that's why supporting the Uluru Statement from the Heart is really critical for all of us as a community, and for Australia, you know, non-Indigenous people as well, and to start having having our real self, meaningful self-determination to be able to deal with this. I do think we can do it, and we're doing a lot. I mean, I was born in 1968, when at the time of the referendum, and a lot has changed since then. So I do think we can do it, and we've certainly shown that during COVID. You know, the amazing leadership that we've had to successfully steer through this, you know, really difficult time in 2020, I think has just demonstrated how much Aboriginal people we can manage our own affairs. When we're able to. So I agree. I think that it's a lot broader, and you support everything that you're saying about, you know, how difficult it is. But we can do it.
And I think there's more people out there chipping away at it than that is known, you know?
Well, that's what we had, Jan, like, in the car on the way in and out there as well. You know, you've studied all this stuff, and you've got to the point where, you know, you can sort of teach people, you know, to do this stuff as well, you know. And you were mentioning, like, you know, every community has, you know, five people who they rely on, you know, especially in small country towns, you know, that there's all those reliable people to sort of go to grieve, to sort of get over things, or to help, you know.
If someone's going off in the community, they know who to go to help de-escalate that person. There's always a sprinkle of people that handle all the, you know, dramas and crises within every community, and they're the people that we try to locate to
well,
skill transference.
In this situation, I'd like for you, Annie Judy Kay, and also Dr. Kath, to give us some ideas around where MOB can go. Let's just say, you know, someone that's never heard about this trauma-informed care that both of you do in different capacities. Starting with you, Dr. Kath.
So there's some fantastic resources being developed by WEALI, as you said, and Dr. Professor Judy Atkinson is one of the chief investigators on the Healing the Past project as well. You can have a look for some of the resources specifically around parenting on our website. There's the Blue Knot Foundation, which is the peak body in Australia for people who have experienced complex trauma. There's the Healing Foundation, which has got some amazing resources around intergenerational trauma, and they're also developing resources for parents. There's the, forgetting the name of it now, on the Health InfoNet, there's a WellMob series as well, but that's five to start with. So there's a lot that is going on in this space at the moment.
And Annie Judy?
Yeah, look, other than the ones already mentioned, there's like the Red Dust Mob, and there's bulk loads, really, of community-based programs and people travelling all around the country doing different things in different capacities.
And if I could put it to the both of you as well, like, you know, people in our communities, we may not be, you know, have the credentials, you know, have the certificates, you know, the doctorates, whatever, you know, to sort of be an expert within the space. But one thing that we are experts in is what happens in our community and what we experience as well.
Yes.
But you know, actually, we're informed, you know, in sort of what goes in our communities. We may not be sort of, you know, have the papers that say we do, but, you know, people in our
leveraging communities, off that too. Then
well, we're
go
usually
on.
The first ones, first point of contact, you know, our MOB.
That's right.
You know, so I guess how do we, you know, deal with those things as well?
You know, like we mentioned Professor Judy Atkinson, she has a lot of community-based workshopping that happens. And like you said before, you know, we locate these sprinkle of people in each community that are always there to respond to whatever's happening in the community. So they're really, really skilled. They haven't got the, you know, the white fella's credentials. But what we do with them is just put a theory base to what they're actually doing. So once you understand the theory of why that's working, you know, like an example of just de-escalating somebody that's in a psychotic state that's really angry, you know. That's a bloody skill you can't learn
and you've
in
been
university.
Teaching, but you've been teaching that at South Australian University, or you did so for
no,
quite a while.
No, it was initially taught up at Central Queensland Uni.
Sorry, Central Queensland, not South Australia.
And it was called Indigenous Therapies then, which developed further into the Masters of Indigenous Studies at Southern Cross University, which I taught into for just under 10 years. Also developed a diploma in community recovery, which allows for the non-professional in the community to have the skills to respond. Because if I could just give a quick example, there was a murder out west. The community went into total crisis. There was a lot of blaming going on, heaps of distress. That community had attached to it 52 different government services, and not one of them could respond to that distress. It took three of us students that was in the Masters at the time learning trauma recovery, trauma and trauma recovery, that was able to stabilise that community. So you've got all these services who are out there, you know, with their big flash titles and whatnot, but they're not trauma-informed. And
or experienced, you know, within community as well, maybe.
That's right.
Kath and Dr. Kath and Annie Kay and Annie Judy, I think it's important as well. I keep getting it wrong, sorry.
You're not the first person out as well.
but it's not to pull away from encouraging blackfellas to engage with their local Aboriginal medical services and whatnot.
No, not encouraging
that at all. No. Yeah. And I didn't mention them, which was a real admission, but I think the Aboriginal community controlled sectors are really leaders in this space in a lot of instances, and you know, certainly they've been taking the lead in Northern Territory and all other states, really.
You say that they've been doing that here in southeast Queensland as well.
Yeah, I'd say everywhere. So I think more so than the non-Indigenous services. So by far, so, definitely recognise the leadership of the community-controlled sector here.
A lot of services are actually reaching out that work with not only Aboriginal people but within the social services, that they know they're clicking on that they need to be trauma-informed in order to deliver a good service.
Yeah. It almost seems so central. Guys, it's been really amazing having you both on this. I think this is the beginning of a discussion that could go on, into the future. Thank you so much for joining us in the studio today, Aunty Judy Kay, and also on the phone, Dr. Catherine Chamberlain. I hope you're doing okay down there, Dr. Catherine, with everything that's been happening. Good luck.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you. It's been a real pleasure to be involved this morning and lovely to talk with you all.
Likewise. Thank you. And thank you, Aunty Judy. And that was Aunty Judy Kay Knox and Dr. Kath Chamberlain, both talking about trauma-informed practice and the importance of including that in care. And thank you so much for joining us here on Let's Talk.